ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Singapore, Malaysia. Maybe. I pronounced that correct. Welcome back to Deliver the Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and I am in need of a vacation. Interesting to hear how many people have tried to take vacations or don't know how to take vacations in the last year, but I'm going to try just taking a week off and doing some things. Got some classes I want to take, some books I want to read. Just going to take some time off and do it. So hope you're doing well. We have a fantastic interview for you today. It's one of those interviews that you really learn a lot. You really get beneficial. Really excited about doing. So we'll get to that in a bit. A couple things from the last few weeks that I think you ought to know about. The first one is an article from Todd Lankford, who has an article called "I Can't Sell Agile to You and Nobody Else Can Either." It's about his journey on working with a team and getting them to try to focus on flow, focus on flow. And he had the case where I've had the similar case, and I'm sure a lot of you have too, where talking isn't working, talking isn't doing. Needed to show them results, and how do you get them to do that? The training is not enough. Several times I've been involved, several times he was as well. Training is not enough. You can't just go to a course. You actually have to do something. You have to try something. And one of his learnings was the team wanted to try mob programming, or I think it's called ensemble programming now, or some people have been calling it ensemble programming instead of mob programming. But anyway, whatever you want to call it, the team, when they were doing that, they had so many ahas, so many different quotes that started to show that they were getting it, that they were clicking it. And he's got some great examples in the article that I think I've heard as well. And the quote that he has in here, which is something that is definitely true, is it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than think your way into a new way of acting. So empirical process control, do the things, try them out, learn from them, ask questions, get better. That's really what the core is about. It's not about the training. It's not about the talking. It's about the doing. So great article from Todd. And I think that will be something that you will resonate with. The other is a video that I watched from Insider, I think Art Insider, called "How Pixar's Movement Animation Became So Realistic." The reason I really like this, Pixar, I think I've talked about them before, and most people who know Pixar or know of Pixar know that they focus intently on the story and the characters, and that drives a lot of what they do. However, how they do it, the technical advances and acknowledgement of technology as a part of their storytelling is so key. And they go all the way back to the original Toy Story, go back to how they have leveraged some of those advancements, or how they've gone past those things, and how they've iterated on that over the years, even up to the latest movie, which was Soul, and how they have really built on the early technologies, modify them in ways they didn't know about, just learning those, using those iterations and using those learnings. You could actually see it when they put it together in the story. You actually see some of the earlier movies where they had things like an octopus, which they found very hard to animate. You see the different octopuses in the different movies as they got consistently better at learning from the past. In one movie, they'd have an octopus that barely moved. Another one, you'd have a little bit of movement. And then another one, you'd have great movement because they've iterated through and they've been able to do that. So interesting to see those connections between the technologies and, again, how those technologies allowed the story to be told. They really did build on what they had. I found that part extremely fascinating, where they would continue to take something like a hand playing guitar and they'd adapt it to a hand playing a bass or a hand playing a keyboard or a piano or something like that, be able to constantly get better. And the thing that I really appreciated is not only are they constantly getting better, but they're constantly releasing good stories, good material, and they're always building on that. And they're not looking at themselves as a failure because they couldn't do certain things. They actually went back and actually said that they downsized some of their or they reduced the amount of movement that they could put in some characters because it didn't fit the character. So like a Toy Story, they specifically limited their movements. And I thought that was fascinating to see. So really good story, really good 20 minutes about how those technology pieces and the animation really helped them tell their great story. So I thought that was fascinating, and maybe you will too.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
My guest today has led product organizations at founding internet era companies, and as the founder of the Silicon Valley Product Group, has helped many more individuals and organizations benefit from his coaching, his books and his blogs, and speaking all over the place. I am pleased to welcome the legendary Marty Kagan to the show. Hi, Marty.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me.
Several times during the show's history, I've referenced your articles. I've encouraged people to read your information and the things you had. I even recommended, did a quick review of the Inspired book that you wrote a little while ago, back on episode 78. I'm really excited to see you continue to write and continue to change, you know, product management in the whole. So I'm very excited that you, A, wrote a new book, and B, that you're agreed to talk to it about it here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
So the new book that you wrote is called Empowered: Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. And I've got some main takeaways that I read from the book, and I want to talk about those as we go through, plus some of the things that just stood out. I had probably 9 pages of notes, and we're not going to get through all of them, but I kind of want to hit on the big topics that hit me, thinking of product and thinking of environments where product is successful and environments where product is not successful. And one of the things you've been talking about, and it was really the main thrust of the book, is there are two different worlds of people that are doing product. There's the best, and then there's everybody else. And that really hit home because I've never worked in the best. I've only worked in the everybody else.
Yeah, unfortunately, I encounter that a lot. In fact, I think that's the biggest obstacle to more companies being better, is that so many people have never seen good. They've never had a chance to see it done well. Because the normal way product skills pass is from your manager down to you, yeah, through coaching. And if you're in a company that has never worked that way, it stays very insular. You can really track it by some of the early great companies. Amazon was one, Google's another, Netscape was another, where people would go to these other companies. As they moved, they brought the practices with them. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of parts of the world, frankly, there are still lots of parts of San Francisco that have not ever seen good. So, I'm doing what I can to try to fix that. And it's not just me, certainly. Several people who've worked in great places have been trying to spread these things out. But it's challenging because there's a much bigger body of people and also knowledge that is on all the old stuff, all the old way of doing things. So, all the business schools, basically, and most of the books, they're really advocating for a very different approach.
And that's what I took away from the book, and actually what started kind of a new path for me these last 4 or 5 months is reading your book and a few others that have kind of coalesced my thinking into, I really want to work for a company that knows how to utilize product and really values those talents. And I think a lot of people are trying to do that. It's just, do they get the opportunity? Do they know where to go to see those things? Because, yes, you've got your Amazons, Googles, and Netflixes that are doing this, the Etsys and some other companies. But what are the real small companies that are trying to do this and doing it well?
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, there are lots of startups that are good, usually because one of the founders has worked in a good place before. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing, I think, more rise of those startups than ever before. If you look at companies like Stripe, yeah, and look at companies like Shopify, and of course you wouldn't call them a startup today, but compared to those big guys, they are, right? They are much, much newer companies.
Yep. One of the lines that I really loved in the book was when you were talking about the fact that these companies that are doing product wrong, that they're spending so much more money on a bunch of waste. Your quote in here is, in fact, I've never seen more wasted technology investment than I find in these companies that don't understand the role of technology. I love that quote because if they're worried about cost or they're worried about saving money or getting better value for their money. They're going about it the really wrong way.
It's ironic, but I think it's really true. We see that. We see it in, you know, governments a lot of times have the same problem as big companies. And so love to see that improved.
And that notion between the best and the rest, the two worlds of product, it seemed like your main thesis is there is that divide of the business and the technology, that the technology teams are there, the delivery teams, whatever you want to call them, are there to serve the business, not collaborate and work with the business. That seems to be the big kind of core feature of most of those worst teams.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's that's really just a symptom. It's not the cause.
The symptom. Okay.
The symptom. I mean, I would argue the cause is how the way the best companies view the role of technology in a company versus how the rest do. The rest of them kind of view technology as a necessary cost. It's just an expense to be managed. Mm-hmm. And as such, they think about it a certain way. They view it as we have lines of business and they generate needs, and they have an IT department that needs to satisfy those needs as best they can. Mm-hmm. That's a symptom of this problem versus, you know, I mean, there's so many examples of this, but you know, you could compare basically any other car company in the world and Tesla.
Right.
You know, Tesla views technology as enabling everything. It basically is a computer on four wheels, right? Mm-hmm. But everybody else, yeah, they have technology. They kind of even have a remarkable amount of technology in there, but it's all viewed as this necessary evil. Yeah, we need an entertainment system. Yeah, we need a navigation system. It's not like, how can we use technology to completely reinvent the experience of driving or the safety of driving or the efficiency of driving? And that's, you know, that's a very fundamental mindset difference.
And you start off the book in one of the most brutally honest ways I love too, which is if you're doing safe or something like that, then this book, why do you want to even read this book? And I love that. It's like, this is not for you, because this is, you actually say this is the polar opposite, both philosophically and practically. This is, if you're doing safe, you're not one of those best companies.
Yeah, I literally can't point to any good company that uses it. And it's, I understand where it comes from. I mean,
sure.
From a marketing point of view, there's a lot of old school IT organizations that miss the days of waterfall and heavy process. And that's perfect for them. They get all the buzzwords. They can check off the buzzwords without any of the work for that. And so, yeah, but it is very disingenuous. There's absolutely no agile and safe. There's absolutely no lean. It's just their MO to add the buzzwords. They just most recently added OKRs.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is really, if you know anything about OKRs, it is ludicrous to think of superimposing that unsafe. It's completely the opposite.
Yep. And in this book, you talk a lot about empowered product teams. And I want to talk a lot about those, because that was kind of my other main takeaway, is the topology of teams and how you talk about that. But one of the things that you've been talking about for a while that I've really picked up and kind of, because it matched one of my philosophies of my own, was that the empowered product teams, the team is there to serve the customers with products that customers love, yet work for the business. And it's very specific in that order. And I see so many times, and I see so many companies that try to put the business first or the product first or the customers first, but not that team aspect first, is have a good team, have a good product, customers love it, business benefits from that. I love that phrasing.
Well, good. I'm glad. I mean, it sounds minor to people, the difference between, well, a feature team's there to serve the business and a product team's there to serve customers in ways that work for the business. But that is a pretty profound difference.
Yeah.
And it changes everything. It changes the skills you need on the team. It changes who actually interacts with customers.
Yeah.
It changes the role of technology. It really fundamentally changes everything. And that's just another one of the ways I was saying we view the difference in the role of technology.
And just like we kind of mentioned in SAFE, is even if you're doing Scrum, but you're not an empowered Scrum team or you're in feature teams or product teams, which is normally what I would think of as good until I read this book, was thinking that feature and product teams are good. It's good if they're focusing on outcomes, but not if they're focusing on outputs or project management, or if that's what my job as a product leader is just as a project manager, that I'm really not an empowered team.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, that's another one today, buzzword is I want to be an empowered team. But what does that really mean? There are some people I find that have a very naive understanding of that. They think that means that the team gets to go figure out whatever they want to work on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, that is not what it means. Just imagine what a company like that looks like. It does mean, though, that you're given problems to solve rather than features to build. And you do get to go figure out the best way to solve that problem. What is the best combination of enabling technology, user experience design, and functionality that solves that problem in a way that the customer will buy, they can figure out how to use, we can build, and works for our business, is viable. That's what it means to be empowered. There's still a very large role for leadership in an empowered organization. They are the ones that are responsible for coming up with the critical problems to solve.
Yeah.
That's really a reflection of the product strategy.
And that empowered product teams leads into things you've talked about before, and you talk about specifically in the book, is missionaries versus mercenaries. Are you there to fulfill a mission? Or are you there just to code? Are you just using your engineers for coding, and that's a bad idea? Or are you using them to solve those higher level business problems and invent new things for your customers? And I really like that distinction between, again, what's the problems we're trying to solve versus just get this built by this date. I like your quote of stop building dumb ideas.
Well, I think, today if you can say empowered team, most people kind of know that's a good thing. But fundamentally, it's why it's good is because, number one, you're tapping into the brains of the people you've hired, right? Like Steve Jobs used to say, we don't hire all these smart people to tell them what to do. We hire these people so they can show us what's possible.
Right.
So that only, you can only take advantage of that in an empowered team. But then to the point you brought up and why I also like that, it's a John Doerr quote, missionaries over mercenaries, is there's obviously a much higher level of motivation.
Yeah.
When you own it, you know, you go to the team and like, this is yours, you know, you own it for better or worse. This is your responsibility, as opposed to just going to them and say, you know, shut up and code, right? Your job is just to code, or your job is just to do wireframes. It's the difference between, feeling real ownership over something and just feeling like an employee, that where my company really could care less, they might as well just outsource me to Accenture or something.
Yeah. And you have a recipe for empowered teams, which I thought was very interesting. And you have these litmus tests all throughout the book, which is, you know, if you're doing this core thing or if you're doing these little things, and they're not hard things. I mean, to your point, this is not hard to do. People just don't want to do it for whatever reason. But the recipe you had in here for empowered teams was really be cross-functional, which is not just a UI and a back-end developer, but have your designers, have your testers, have your marketing people, have your cross-functional teams on there. That's one. They are empowered to solve problems, just like you mentioned. And the third one is that they are accountable for the results. And that's where we talk about the ownership, and where I try to get people when I'm working with them is like, you really should be able to own this solution and outcome and all of it. Even as an engineer, a junior engineer on a team, you're still should be responsible or feel responsible for these types of outcomes.
Yeah, I would argue if you're working in a good environment and you have a good manager, even when I was a junior engineer, I did feel very empowered and I felt very much ownership. Now, they weren't big things that I was responsible for as a brand new engineer. I was still learning the difference between theory and practice and all that.
Yeah.
But they were real. I mean, I literally felt another great Bezos quote is, we need people that think like owners, not think like employees. And that was the culture I was brought up into. That was super important that you get people to feel like it's theirs. And of course, that's a big part of the sort of Silicon Valley strategy is to literally make people an owner with with stock options, that's really plays a big role.
Another big takeaway that I had not heard before, seen before, that I took from this is when you're talking about teams and power teams, you set them up not as the feature or the delivery teams, you set them up as customer experience teams, teams with a specific persona they're trying to solve for. And then the platform teams, which is if you have a big monolith, or not a big monolith application, but a big application that has lots of moving parts, you're going to need some core services or some core parts that multiple experience teams leverage. But you're also going to need to focus those teams on that customer mission or that persona mission. And I really like that setup. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been a thing for a long time in good companies, because as soon as you're past small stage, it's all about leverage and getting organizations to move faster and feel real ownership. So this is a thing. But one of the reasons I really dialed it up in the book, and my co-author, Chris Jones, is that a lot of people have a very unrealistic and naive view about what it means to be an autonomous team. Mm. They think that you have a dependency, it's broken. And I'm like, that is only true in the tiniest startups. Once you have more than about 20 engineers, that is never true, or at least I have never seen it true anymore. Mm. You will always have dependencies. The question is, are you minimizing those dependencies, and are you managing those that are there? Netflix likes to have the mantra, we need teams that are highly aligned but loosely coupled. Mm-hmm. So notice they say, don't say uncoupled, because that would be a truly autonomous team. They say loosely coupled. Minimize that coupling. And that makes a very big difference, because having a small number of platform dependencies is way more empowering. And also, you're able to innovate much more, because you have a much higher level of abstraction to work with than in the idea of a quote, full stack, totally autonomous team that has all the skills they need going all the way down, but they can hardly do anything because their scope is so narrow.
Yeah, and it's not only the number of dependencies and the where they occur, but the impact of those dependencies. Do they stop you cold? Do they inconvenience you? Do you have to find ways around them? I've worked with both types of teams where, you know, there was a dependency on a team and it stopped us cold. We couldn't go further until that other team delivered, which was bad. Yeah, sure. But I've also worked with teams where we managed those dependencies or lessened the impact of them, where, you know, there was an API interface that those teams agreed on, and you could mock one end of it, and the other team, you know, when they built theirs, it was fine. We put them together then, but you worked around those dependencies and it didn't have that big of an impact on you.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you consciously take a dependency on, it's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. So for example, when thousands and thousands of companies today, I think it's literally millions, decide to build on top of AWS from Amazon, that's a conscious dependency. Mm-hmm. They could go to the iron. They could run their own data center. They could do all that. They're making a conscious dependency. Now, to me, it's a no-brainer choice. Yeah. It is a thousand times better to leverage them. Even Netflix, which is pretty awesome, even they say it's not worth doing that themselves. And most companies I know are nowhere near as good as Netflix. And Netflix is like, no. In fact, not only are they taking a dependency on AWS, they're fully aware that their biggest competitor is also Amazon. So they just know that it's a worthwhile trade-off. And sometimes, like one of the teams I work with right now, is waiting on a change from Amazon or AWS. It happens.
Yeah.
And it's a downside. That's not a feature. That's a bug. But it's still a good choice for them. And they've been able to put their energies into really where it matters, which is not reinventing what AWS does.
You're not gonna win that battle.
You're not gonna win it. Not even close. There's like four players that if the table stakes do it. And they're all good. I mean, Amazon is not the only one. They all are different, but they are, you know, it's a tough argument to say we shouldn't use any one of those four. We should build that ourselves. That's like Well, you got a lot of work to convince me.
And then the other thing that you started to get into, which is why don't companies do this? Why don't they empower their teams more? And it's something I've read a lot and we've heard a lot is it comes down to trust. The CEOs, the leaders of the organizations don't trust either teams, but more importantly, I think, and I think you mentioned this in one of your talks, is they don't trust the product people that are leading those teams.
Yeah, it really is very common situation. And I also try to be sensitive to this, because I have met many of these CEOs that tell me they don't trust. And they also point out to me, you know, after I meet their teams, you know, I wouldn't trust them either. So they're you know, they have to be trustworthy.
Yes.
Now, it really does require work on both sides. The product teams, and I am constantly trying to get the product teams to step up their game, especially product managers, because it's really hard to go to the CEO and say, come on, you need to trust these people, and then they're not trustworthy. That doesn't work. That doesn't last long. I've never seen it last long. Because, you know, ultimately that CEO is accountable, responsible for the company, answers to a board. So those teams have to be up to it. But once those teams show that they're trustworthy, which honestly is, I don't think is that hard. It takes effort and it takes coaching, but it is definitely doable. I've seen it in thousands of teams. But once that's done, it is a lot easier then to go to the CEO and say, look, I think this team has demonstrated they are trustworthy. Mm-hmm. They understand the data. They understand the customers. They understand the strategy. They understand the vision. They understand the business constraints. That's what we're looking for. That's what you should be trusting.
Yeah.
If they don't understand those things, then you're basically just setting up a company to fail.
And once they understand those things, is it then delivering on that promise of, you know, frequent changes in customer behavior that the customers really like that then benefit the business to loop back to that main point you're talking about? Is that how you build the trust?
Yeah. Once you sort of earn the sort of, you could call it, probationary trust, right? You sort of, they understand that you've done the homework, then they're usually willing to let you go for a while. And a while usually means like 3 to 6 months, where they're looking, what they're hoping for is some outcomes.
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody's doing this for. They're like, we're taking a big leap of faith here and we're hoping for those outcomes. Now, when the outcomes start to roll in, now we're in good shape. Now we can start really spreading this across the rest of the organization.
Yeah.
If they don't roll in, that's where we have a problem. You know, the company's willing to try it, but not indefinitely. They're not giving the organization a blank check. So that's why I spend a lot of my time trying to get the teams, especially the product managers, to raise their game.
And you talk about culture a little bit in the book, but you don't spend too much time specifically on culture. And I'm wondering, in some of the other things I've read, is this leaning more toward product-led type organizations? And you don't really talk about that specifically either that I picked up. But is there some combination of product-led or product-focused culture that helps with this enablement?
Yeah, I mean, the reason you didn't see much talk about culture was intentional. I used to talk a ton about culture because I love the topic. But then it was sort of pointed out to me pretty clearly that, okay, I'm always citing these great companies. Like if you, for example, if you've ever been inside Apple, Google, and Amazon, those are three, you know, poster children for great products.
Sure.
But it's also true they all have three very different cultures. They have three really different cultures, especially if you look at, like, on one end of the spectrum's Amazon and Google's at the other end of the spectrum. They have very different cultures, yet they're all excellent at product. What that tells you, it tells me, is it's not really about culture. It's about something more fundamental than culture. And what, you know, a lot of us, what we mean by culture is sort of the sort of preferences and sort of characteristics of the founders showing through. But what I argue is really going on is this idea of hire smart people and coach them and empower them. And that's really the difference. Now, that's not some brilliant insight from me. I literally got that from the guy who was coaching the leaders of those three companies, Bill Campbell. He was like, look, leadership's job is to provide the environment that's necessary for teams to do good work. And that's, I think, I think that's right. That's spot on. It's sort of, you know, obviously it includes parts of culture, but it's deeper, I think, than culture. It really has to do about what you think of your people and what their role is in your company. Mm-hmm. Not just like, do we allow people to play ping pong at, you know, and serve nice lunches and stuff like that.
Yeah, a lot of good that's done in the past year.
Exactly. A lot of dusty ping pong tables out there.
Yes. And actually, I'm going to jump down to that section to talk about leadership and management since you mentioned that. So I'm about, actually, because of your book, one of the next ones I picked up was Trillion Dollar Coach, and I'm about 75% through that book. Really enjoying that one. But you do make a distinction between leadership and management. Leadership, and I've you know mentioned leadership before in the show, you spend a good amount of time on that. In fact, one of the quotes from the book that I really like is, the idea is to demonstrate how their lives will improve in some meaningful way. As product leaders, we have to constantly talk about that for the product vision with our teams and customers.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying not to be very theoretical on this, just on a practical level. Management is staffing and coaching.
Yeah.
That's really what we mean, staffing and coaching. And leadership is really about motivating. And so it's sharing the context. Andy Grove, there's a quote I've been using lately because he was a legendary CEO, of course. And he used to say, look, there's only two ways things go wrong in a product company. The first is that your people don't know how to do good work. Mm. The second is they know how to do good work. They just don't want to. So the first is management. The second is leadership.
Yeah.
And it's really true. And that's another one of those things. I didn't even realize how lucky I was. But like for the first 10 years, literally, of my career, every single day I had at least one manager who was assigned to help me get better at my job, assigned to coach me. And I meet so many people that have been working for even more than 10 years, and they've never had a manager do that. And it's like, to me, that's a crime. That's like totally irresponsible of the managers. And you know, because this stuff is not taught in university. It's learned hands-on with teams, working with engineers, working with designers, working with customers, working with enabling technology. And so without that coaching, people just thrash.
Yeah, the quote you had in there, and it's something that you helped explain it a little bit better than I previously have been able to when I'm coaching teams or working with teams, is when you switch to this way of working, coaching is the manager's biggest explicit responsibility. It's what they're there for.
Yep.
You actually had the quote is, I hope you come to realize that this is what your job is really all about. And you use this as a framework for giving coaching an honest effort. No matter how you got there, if your job is manager in an empowered product team, your job is there to coach.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the biggest single topic in the new book.
Yeah. So I really like that. You also talk about objectives and staffing. Again, if you've seen this, it's a lot easier to do it. If you've never seen it, it's a lot harder to hire for the people. The A's hire B's and B's hire C's. You know, that type of argument is you have to hire people that know how to do this, or at least are willing to do this. And if you hire somebody who has potential, I love this quote too, because I've done this myself. If you hire somebody based on potential, you better be willing to coach them yourself to bring them up to speed.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about the vision. Strategy is the other thing. You know, what connects the teams and the vision? That's your product strategy, and that's what you spend a good amount of too. Whereas again, that two-world metaphor, the other teams don't really have a strategy. You don't mean bad strategy. You mean literally no strategy, or the strategy is to serve the business, and that's really bad. I hate that.
But that's what it is in so many companies. Typical feature teams, project teams, they're just there to serve the business. And, you know, they're really measured by how much of this stuff they can crank out.
Yep.
And of course, it's what's amazing to me is for decades, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, 30 years, we have known that that way of working generates a very low batting average, meaning a very small percentage actually meet the business goals of the company.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise to anybody who's conscious, I think, why so many software efforts are failures. The only question to me is, why in the world do they keep doing that, you know, for so many years? And of course, it doesn't take long in a large company for it just to get institutionalized.
Yeah.
Where the stakeholders are told, you own this, you're responsible, you generate a roadmap every quarter, the teams will, IT will do their best to build it.
Yep. The other interesting thing, and I've got this as a note for a future show, is you dig into product principles, is what is your product founded around? What are those hard decisions that you're already going to make that your product needs to follow? You talk about the eBay buyer and seller of, and I like that example of, you know, a buyer may want to do certain things that are bad for the seller. And as a product team, as an organization, we're not going to do those things. We've already made those trade-offs. I like that concept.
Yeah, it kind of goes with a product vision, but you're going to face these sort of quandaries. Every organization is. So better to, rather than let every team struggle through it themselves and come up with however many different answers, that's really a good example of the role of leadership to say, look, we're going to have this tension. We need to decide what is our point of view as a company here. It may be literally just because we know the financial dynamics depend on this. It may be an ethical issue. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, we should think about that, state it, so that we can have, you know, it's like a vision is meant to be that common North Star, and the principles are meant to be those common values.
And I really like that. You talk about priorities too, and we beat priorities up to death. But I really like, and I agree with the statement that you have in there, is that teams or products usually have 20 to 30 important things where they only need to have two or three. Yeah. That's a very fun conversation. I love coming into organizations or coming into product teams and ranking, you know, 1 through 67, how many initiatives they have going on, and go, okay, this is too many. What are the things that are really important, and how can we move these up or move other ones out and not focus on them?
And, you know, I try to point out that's yet another consequence of that big divide we started with. If you're trying to serve the business and the business wants 67 things, which they do, then it begs the prioritization question.
Yeah.
However, if on the other hand, you've got an empowered organization, you have a product vision, which is where you're trying to go, you've got a small number of company objectives, usually two or three, then the product strategy sort of obviates that whole prioritization discussion. It is making the choices based on data, based on insights about what are the specific problems we need solved.
Yeah.
And in practice, in good organizations, the prioritization is really not a thing like it is.
Right.
Obviously, if you've got two priorities, you want to know which one's more important. But that's not 1 through 67.
Right.
That's just tell us what the company, you know, trade-off is on this. So that's just a symptom of the old way of work.
It's those higher level conversations that I've found are useful, where don't argue about the prioritization, argue about what we're prioritizing, strategy-wise or vision-wise or principle-wise. I love having those next level conversations because people get too in the weeds on some of those things.
Yes.
The other thing that I really took away that I want to do now, actually the next book I'm going to read is the Team Topologies book, because you mentioned that so many times, and Empowered, is the way you set your teams up and evangelize with them is key. We talked about those experienced teams and platform teams, but don't ship your org chart. I love that quote. So many organizations do that, but really focus not only your managers on coaching, but focus your teams better, organize them better to solve those real problems.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out too, because I think you'll enjoy reading the Team Topologies book, but it's worth pointing out the two co-authors of that book, they are DevOps guys. Mm-hmm. And they introduced the term team topology. And I knew one of them, and I reached out and I said, you know, where did you get that term? Because we've always, for 20 years, we've described this topic as how do you structure your product teams? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really have a name. It's just a thing. We structure product teams. But they introduced a name and they said, no, they tried it out at a talk they gave and it seemed to really resonate. And I told them I loved it and I was going to use it and just reference them.
Yeah.
Now, their book, Also, I mean, in Empowered, there's a major section on team topologies.
Right.
And their book is all on team topologies. But there is a difference. You know, whenever you do a team topology, you choose consciously when you want to optimize it for. Mm-hmm. And topologies can be optimized legitimately for lots of different things.
Right.
In their book, they talk about our assumption here is what we want to optimize for is flow.
Okay.
Is basically how much throughput you can get through an organization.
Right.
Now, first of all, I'd say that's not an unreasonable thing to optimize for.
Sure.
And boy, if you're a DevOps person, that's probably the most obvious thing to optimize for. But in a good product organization, I would argue, while it's still good, it's not really the most important thing. Because in a good product organization, it's not so much about throughput, it's about how much impact you can make. Mm-hmm. It's not just about how much code you can push through, it's about good code pushing through. And I don't just mean quality. I mean, like, does it actually solve the problem?
Yes.
So what we talk about is empowering, is a team topology that optimizes for empowerment versus optimizing for flow.
Okay.
Now, it turns out there's some overlap there, and you'll see that. You know, they talk about platform teams. They talk about experience teams. So there's some definite overlap.
Okay.
But it's important to keep in mind they were optimizing for something different. And I think if they were focused on, you know, and the truth is they picked a good thing to optimize for because there are so many, because the truth is their stuff is useful even if it's not a tech product organization.
Yeah.
Like the ones I care about. But if you care about what I do in Empowered Teams, you're going to want to put a lens on this that's a little different than the lens that they have.
Now, that's great. And I'm looking forward to reading that. And I do agree that that difference between flow and kind of impact is, there's probably, you know, 60, 70% overlap, I'm sure. But companies would benefit from just having optimized flow as well, even if they don't get to the product side.
No, most companies, their topologies are a mess. So they're more historical than anything else. And frankly, most of them are dominated by tech debt anyway. So, you know, the tech debt kind of throws a wrench into any topology discussion. So, yeah, it's a super good topic. It's also a very hard topic.
Absolutely. And you do touch in the book about methodologies. You talk about Agile and Lean a little bit. I don't want to get into those, but I like the quote that you've had it a couple times, which is, and I've shared your four product risks, right? If your four product risks, is it valuable? Can we build it? Can the user figure it out? And does it work for our business? I love those four risks. And you actually add a fifth risk in here, which is about the ethics of should we build it? And those override any process methodology or anything else that you're looking at.
Yeah, the way I like to think about it, because I'm not religious about most teams I work with, they're either using Kanban or XP, or they might just be getting started, so they're using Scrum, but they're just using something. Mm-hmm. And some of companies are using nothing. They just have their own, they work reasonably well, they ship small increments frequently. That's all we really care about. When I look at an organization, I'm actually looking at a higher level, one level higher. There's three things, honestly, that I'm looking for. And I would say I find this in all the best companies, and it's missing even in companies that call themselves agile, but are not. Number one, there's what you brought up. Are they addressing those four risks before your engineers are writing a line of code? If they're using their engineers to address those risks, that's just going to be very slow, very inefficient. That's the old sort of the anti-pattern of the four-month MVP. It's terrible. You know, you just know they're not working smart. So that's the first issue. The second issue is, how do they actually solve problems? Is it the waterfall way, which is a product manager defining user stories or even product requirement documents, throwing it to a designer and say, give me some wireframes and comps, and then bringing that stack of documents to sprint planning and telling the engineers to code it? That's not how good teams work. That is literally waterfall.
Yeah, of course.
And even though these companies, they see it at sprint planning. I tell them it's hardly, it's superficial agile at best.
Even if you do it quickly, it's still waterfall.
Yeah, because really we're getting at a different issue. Whether the sprint is a day or a year doesn't even matter.
Right.
The point is the engineers are brought in way too late. And what I'm looking for in that second point is, how do they actually solve problems? What we're looking for is engineering, design, and product solving them together. Mm-hmm. Because a good solution is a collaboration of those three skills. So that's the second thing I'm looking for. And the third thing I'm looking for is, do they celebrate when they ship a feature, or do they celebrate when they achieve an outcome?
Mm. Okay.
Those are the three things. If those three things are going on, I really could care less what development process you're using, what delivery process you're using. Kanban fits there, and Kanban and XP seem to fit the best to that mm-hmm. sort of way, that philosophy, but I don't care. I don't care. Some of the best companies out there, they don't even care what agile is. It doesn't matter. They are doing these things.
Yeah. And I like your point of, you don't want to be religious about the agile space. I mean, you talk about a little bit, but to your point, those three things are so much more important than, are you doing Scrum or do you have product owners or any of those other conversations that we could have. Let's have conversations about how can we impact those risks? How can we celebrate the outcomes that we're doing?
Well, and since you brought it up, the reason I don't consider myself religious against SAFe, I consider myself more dogmatic against it. But the problem with SAFe is it literally prevents those three things.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, it's a process. Absolutely, it's a process for scaling how you build stuff. But those three things are not only not incorporated, they're really, you're working against the rules to actually do that. And so I'm like, that's like, okay, that's the polar opposite of what we're talking about. Yeah. And I think that's fundamentally why good companies don't use it.
You also mentioned that all this talk about digital transformations or agile transformations or any of these other transformation journeys or whatever path people want to call it, that very few people or very few companies are able to actually do it. Because all the things we've talked about, that's what you actually have to do. Again, not hard. You make a point, is it's not hard, but you actually have to do these things. And so many companies can't get out of their own way to do it.
Yeah, and the other thing on transformation that I try to really emphasize is that the thing is, transformation goes way beyond the engineers, designers, and product managers.
Yeah.
It impacts finance, it impacts HR, it impacts sales, marketing, it impacts legal, it impacts biz dev. And so people don't understand that, which is why they think, oh, we'll just have a chief digital officer and they'll worry about this. And what happens is, as soon as it goes outside of that smaller unit mm-hmm. into the others, now these executives go to the CEO and say, I don't want to do this crap. And so unless the CEO is willing to say, yes, you are, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So it's normally a bad sign when the CEO is designated somebody as chief digital officer or transformation mm-hmm. officer. I asked them, like, do you think Amazon would have a chief digital officer? Do you think Tesla would have a chief digital? No, this is like all of us. Every one of us are in this. So, they're trying to put it in a box rather than deal with it.
And to the point of scaling, I like the quote here that you don't scale product work with process, you scale it with leadership of people, management of people, coaching of people. That's how you want, if you want to scale your organization, look at that first. Don't worry about the process.
Yeah.
The process will figure itself out. I like that.
There's a great quote too that comes from Netflix, which is lead with context, not process. They also say lead with context, not control. Same thing. That's how you lead. You give the teams the context to make decisions themselves. You don't just command and control the organization.
Very good. So I love the book, even though I don't work in organizations that actually would do this, but I like being inspired, and it's actually something that I want to do, right? It's something that I want to find organizations that do this, or I want to tell people what it really takes to do this. And this book is a great way to kind of see what the best companies do, how they actually change. Again, I can't recommend it enough, Empowered, even if you want to just read it as a fantasy novel, because some people, maybe that's exactly what they see is, we can't do this. But it's aspiring, I think, as well. So I highly encourage everybody to go out and get empowered and read it. So anything else, any other messages or things people have been talking about the book, Marty, that you want to share?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you felt that way. Obviously, that's what what gives me optimism is today more industries are being disrupted than ever.
Yeah.
So I am finally hearing from a whole segment of CEOs that wouldn't even have called me ever. They had no interest, no knowledge of it, no interest in it. And now for the first time, I'm hearing from CEOs. Now, of course, what's really going on is they're scared.
Yeah.
They're scared, rightfully. Even execs that are huge companies that you'd think were totally locked in with government support and the whole thing, and they're realizing. So the fact that there are, you know, because Amazon is only too happy to disrupt your space.
Sure.
If you don't want to take care of your customers, they will.
Yep.
And Stripe is doing that in financial services. Shopify is doing that in e-commerce. I mean, just there are so many good places waiting to take care of your customers if you won't. So that gives me a lot of optimism that even if your company hasn't done it or hasn't had the appetite for it before, this may force the issue.
Very cool. Okay. One thing I do, Marty, with every new first-time guest, I ask them three questions, and there are standard three questions. Are you ready for your three questions?
Go for it.
Tell me three products that you use in your personal life or work life, whichever one, that you love, and tell me why you love them.
Oh, the only hard thing for me is to narrow it down to, as a product person, I sort of gravitate to these things.
Yeah.
There are a lot of great products out there. What would be some fun examples? And some are obvious. Like I would argue that the iPhone and AWS are two products that are absolutely exceptionally good products and have enabled, but everybody talks about those. let's see. I recently gave props to a company, Garmin. You've heard of Garmin.
Yes.
Because Garmin is like this quiet Midwestern company that I think they have groups all over. I've never worked with them, but I am very impressed. They have been consistently innovating in so many spaces, and so many. Just the latest device that I saw is they have a for safety for bicyclists. They literally did a LiDAR-based detector that's this big that goes under your seat and alerts you when there's an approaching hazard from behind.
Wow.
It alerts you with audio, just with a beautiful integration, just very impressive technology. I was also very impressed on the subject of, we could go in any direction on this, but I was very impressed with Peloton. Now, Peloton has struggled recently with a huge ethical issue, if you followed, and I am, I don't know the CEO, but CEO really screwed up in terms of ethics and how he managed this crisis with safety involving one of their new product lines. But the Peloton is a very impressive device that, on the ethical side, I would say it's probably saved thousands of lives already on what it's done. It is probably one of the few examples of game mechanics applied for good rather than for bad.
Yeah.
So, and they have done an exceptionally good job on those mechanics to simulate, that what they did is they took the best of the in-gym experience and took away all the limitations.
Yeah.
And it's far superior, I would argue, to the in-person experience. So they have done a great job. And you know, they deserve a lot of the success. They just have to be a little smarter on how they manage their business.
Yep, their community, when I see people talking about, they talk about the people that they're riding with or the class people. So the community aspect of that is great.
And also what's impressive for those in the product design is they have done a good job in simulating that community if you're not actually wanting or able to interact with them live.
Sure.
So yeah, there's a lot to it. If you've never actually seen it, I would suggest, since I'm on the theme of devices, I would definitely recommend trying, you know, a Peloton, even if you're not into fitness or anything, try it to see how they've done this. And then I would also say, absolutely drive a Tesla. Just do a test drive of a Tesla. The way Tesla has used technology to reinvent something that was very old, obviously driving, is remarkable and a great example of a strong product, very strong product, super hard kind of product to do.
Okay. Second question, I'm going to change it because you talk a lot about what product people are doing, and that's kind of where I go with my standard second question. But I think something I'm interested from you is when you're seeing product leaders and product managers that are in the trenches with teams, what are they doing that's surprising you?
Well, on a good or bad sense?
In a good sense, in the last year, what's kind of the new techniques or the new practices or the new questions that they're asking that is something that, A, you haven't talked about yet, but you're starting to see patterns?
Yeah, well, the last year has been dominated, obviously, by the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so it has actually made the job of product leaders and product managers pretty significantly harder. I would say that some jobs have been neutral to even beneficial, especially working from home. Product and product leadership are not two of those jobs. Those are so collaboration-based. They're so trust-based. So, you know, in the good sense, I've seen a lot of, you know, several leaders have realized this early on, and they've really upped their game in terms of coaching because they've needed to.
Yeah.
Now, even with them upping their game, I think they'd be the first to tell you it's still not good enough. So I could have really answered that either direction. But I think the good news is that people are starting to realize. And the other, this is sort of a silver lining from the pandemic. You might have noticed, like, early on in the pandemic, Google said, well, we're not only work from home, we're going to be work from home indefinitely. Yeah, well, that didn't last, you might have noticed. That didn't last because they realized, oh, wow, yeah, our innovation just falls off a cliff. And why is that? Well, we're realizing how collaboration really plays a role in innovation and how much harder that is. Atlassians realize the same thing. All good companies that are paying attention are seeing that there are some hard problems that we were taking for granted that are now clear. And so we have some real work to do as an industry if we're going to get the level of innovation from work from home. The good news is, I think going forward, is we're going to have a lot of hybrids. And I think those hybrids will, like a Peloton, be the best of both worlds.
Very cool. Okay. And third question, you talked about Teslas and Pelotons and all kinds of other things. What kind of product ideas are you most excited about in the future?
Well, I would say that pretty much characterizes why I love product, is because the enabling technology is changing every single day. I mean, literally every day, whether it's machine learning technology or big data technology or consumerization of the enterprise or Bitcoin technology, people are realizing that there's things they've always wanted to do, but were never really possible. And so that's what I think is so great about our industry, is that what's possible is changing literally daily. And so this is what, for people, you know, obviously some people hate that, the people who hate change. I know a lot of them. And other people live for it. This is what makes life great. If things stop changing, this, to me, after 3 months, our whole industry would be incredibly boring.
Yeah. Is there one application, though, or a company that you've worked with that's doing something that's brand new that you haven't seen before, or that's building on something that's been barely used that you're like, I want to use that app every day?
Well, I do think there's a lot of them that are using these enabling technologies to do things that I didn't even you know, well, most of this sort of the characteristic of great products. Most of the users never even knew it was possible. For example, voice control technology has gotten so much better recently. Another product that's amazing to me, even though I'm not in the target demographic, I appreciate what they've done, which is TikTok.
Yeah.
TikTok has very impressive enabling technology, has very impressive design, has, and of course, created probably the most addictive app I've ever seen. This is very similar to the earlier question of great products out there, but there are a lot of things people are doing that, people imagined. Steve Jobs used to hold up his iPhone and say, you can conduct 100 focus groups, you'll never get an iPhone. And that's the point, is that this is why technology products, we are creating things that people didn't even know was possible every day.
Very good. All right. Thank you, Marty. Those are your three questions. And I encourage everybody, like I said, again, go out, get inspired first, because Empowered is kind of a sequel to Inspired. I think you've said that before. So read both of those, read the blogs, do all those things. You can follow Marty at Kagan on Twitter, and the website is svpg.com to see all the other things. And you've got a third book coming from one of your partners coming out later this year, right?
Yeah, we don't have a date yet, but there's a book on product marketing coming out too.
Very cool. Okay. Anything else you want to let folks know about Marty?
I hope this was useful. Thank you very much.
For any feedback or questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliverCast or email us at DeliverCast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. We will not get to questions today. We will try to make it up next show. Please go buy Marty's book, follow him, and enjoy his teachings. Don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that over at seektaiju.com. All opinions expressed here are mine. Find more of them at Corey Bryant on Twitter. That is episode 123 delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.